We're talking about Kenosha here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 16 weeks ago, a black man was shot 7 times in the back by a Kenosha police officer. Jacob Lake remains paralyzed. Whether to charge the officer, that still is under review. But rallies continue. This footage from the Kenosha Times Saturday, Executive Director of Leaders of Kenosha, Tanya McLean, speaking in Civic Center Park.
Despite the tragic circumstances that happened to Jacob, a lot of good has come out of this. We've come together as a community, as a people, and awareness is being brought to Kenosha on the injustices and the systemic racism that's happening here.
How did Kenosha make you think about racial injustice and white privilege? Where do we go as a state and nation? It's 800-642-1234. John Eason is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison, where he founded and directs the UW Justice Lab. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm thinking of Kenosha organizer Tanya McLean's speech there on Saturday, and she's bundled in a parka in the park. Only her eyes are showing, speaking into that megaphone, you know, the flurries falling. And I'm thinking, you know, seasons change since that August Day shooting of Jacob Blake, but do people change? John, what has changed in Kenosha?
So the main thing to point out in the article and the white paper is that Kenosha, like many of the small cities in Wisconsin, is undergoing rapid demographic change in terms of the racial composition. So basically more black and Latinx folks are moving into neighborhoods and into communities across Wisconsin that were typically believed to be only white. The other major change is, and this is the key part, I think, that fits in with what you've been discussing this whole morning, is that Republican and Democratic voters are now more and more living in the same neighborhood. So people, the belief that folks live far away from each other, these are people who are in close contact, close social contact. So this creates conditions that can potentially lead to big issues.
And how does a city or town change when more people of color move into a community, or, as you say, people who have different partisan views, partisan lenses, now live shoulder to shoulder, home to home, apartment to apartment, in the same vicinity?
So what happened in the case of Kenosha, and what we've seen in a host of other, this is true across the U.S. And a host of other communities. When people of color move in, whites sometimes or often are threatened by this buildup of the other. And what happens is they request more policing and more funding for policing. And this is independent of whether or not crime is actually increasing. So what's happened in Kenosha is there was more and aggressive policing. What we did in analyzing data over time, trends over time, is found that there were more Republican voters who may have been Democratic in the past were more likely to vote Republican in these communities in response to these changing demographics.
We're talking with John Eason, who's an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison, and we're talking about racism and what we have learned from Kenosha, what we've learned from the Black Lives Matter protests this summer and the shooting of Jacob Blake, and how communities are changing, the makeup of them. Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. John, you looked specifically at Kenosha's police department and how it has changed, how it has grown. Was that in response to more crime on the streets? What caused the police department to grow?
So we saw, we looked at, and this is on our website under white papers on the UW Justice Lab, and we used the Uniform Crime Report system to look at both violent crime and property crime over time. And relatively speaking, crime has either it's either flat or gone down. It really hasn't been a huge spike in crime while its racial while people of color moved in. So the growth in the police department, and actually compared to other cities, Kenosha is doing, it's about average, right, in terms of, it's below average in terms of its crime report, I mean, in terms of its crime statistics, right? But the number of police officers has grown, which doesn't exactly, it doesn't, normally the budget for policing and police and the number of police would correspond with, you know, it would make sense if there were more crime, but there isn't. So we don't have a detailed analysis to be able to tell you exactly the causal reason that did, but the preliminary analysis we've done points towards trends with other papers that have been published that suggests that it was motivated by a response to the growth in the number of people of color.
You bring this example of something called the racial threat hypothesis. What is that?
So racial threat holds that as the number of people of color, Black or Latinx, move into a white community, that the community will respond by increasing the amount of punishment or social control, so the means of control. So that means everything from policing to building more jails, prisons, and the like. It's a response, it's sort of a knee-jerk response to this racial change. There's more, this is at best corollary. We found this correlation, and given what happened in Kenosha, we felt it was important to sort of contextualize and give a little history of how this came about, to really investigate how these things happen over time. I think it requires a deeper dive, but just from knowing what we know about the police response, and the fact that we did interviews there, over time, I have a number of students who are, doing interviews all across the state, doing a number of different research projects. The ones that worked on this were Benny Witowski, Chloe Hampson, and Jung-Myung Kim. And they're looking not only, not just these students, but all of my students. They're interviewing prosecutors. They're interviewing police officers. They're interviewing people returning from prison or jail. The main thing that came across and what prompted all of this was the fact that we were going through interview data, and one of the students found this quote about "you protect and serve who," right? And this is directly out of an interview with someone from a community like Kenosha, or from Kenosha specifically. So we were really intrigued to figure out why the respondent, a Black respondent, was saying this about the police in that city. And that's what prompted us just doing, digging into records to figure out what's going on in Kenosha.
UW-Madison sociologist John Eason has been thinking about, as he said, what is going on in Kenosha? What is happening here to a community and the broader picture in Wisconsin? How did you reckon with police violence this year? How did it touch your life, your community? Do you see your community healing? And if so, in what ways? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Eason here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we discuss policing, racism, what it means for Kenosha following the Jacob Blake shooting 16 weeks ago. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. At a rally Saturday in Kenosha's Civic Center Park, this is Jacob Blake's uncle, Justin Blake, with a message to supporters.
This isn't just justice for little Jacob. You got to understand that. This is for all the little Jakes those mothers have to pray when they go outside the door that they come back safely.
That footage from Kenosha News, how did you see your community differently through Kenosha? Have you joined protests against racial inequality and police brutality? Share with us, 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison sociologist John Eason as our guide. John, in all of these interviews, what did Black residents of Kenosha tell you about their experiences living there?
It's really consistent in terms of what people have seen, what people are reporting across the state. I was on WPR last year to talk about, and on Wisconsin Public Television to talk about Wisconsin having several of the worst cities for African Americans to live in. So it just provided more granular data for how the statistics that we see. Basically, there are challenges not just from the police in terms of over-policing, but there's aggressive policing, the way people are treated once they are stopped. And this doesn't just mean people being shot. There's a whole host of other ways people are treated when they're stopped by in certain communities, right? We know that Wisconsin also, just from a statistical point of view, is the nation, one of the leaders in the nation in terms of disproportionate rate of incarceration of African Americans. So those experiences came through as well, and that meant stories from everywhere, every point in the criminal justice system, from contact with the police to parole officers to the way that state's attorneys exercise discretion. So it wasn't just in Kenosha. We have interviews through the lab with the students reaching out across the state to talk to a number of different stakeholders. Mm-hmm. But overall, the picture is not great. That's the bottom line. And it really confirms, it just triangulates and confirms the quantitative or descriptive data we already have.
When you talked with white residents about their relationships with their neighbors, their Black residents, and the police, what did you find? What did you hear there?
We have not done extensive interviews with white residents about that specific question, so I can't really speak on that.
Okay.
But the interviews we have done with white residents is more so their involvement with the criminal justice system. And that's been that. What's interesting about Wisconsin, even though we have this high disproportionate rate of incarceration, the way that we're actually continuing to incarcerate white people in this white and rural residents is quite remarkable as well. So when we talked with residents, it was more so about their experience with the criminal justice system and not so much with their other residents.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with John Eason, who's an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison, and we're talking about social justice, what Kenosha brought to the forefront in seeing communities everywhere reckon with systemic racism. And we're looking at John's research at and what it's brought out as he's founder and director of the UW Justice Lab. Taking your questions and your insights as well at 800-642-1234. John, I was thinking about Tanya's words here, the Kenosha resident who's helped organize these rallies. And Tanya was saying, we want opportunity. We want safe housing. We want safe neighborhoods. We want equitable education, equitable health care. We don't even have a grocery store. I mean, these are basic human needs in a first world community. What can you say there? What is that disparity like?
I think that we'd have to really question and challenge if all of the U.S. is actually first world. There are elements, there are parts of the U.S. In small urban, small rural or places, small cities like Kenosha, and especially in the southern U.S.
I was going to say Mississippi rural areas are devastated.
Yes, they're devastated. So I'd have to challenge the notion that we all live in a first world society. I think that there are some places, there are glimmers of hope. The Blake family has strong connections to my hometown of Evanston, Illinois. And that through a referendum, through some legislation, local legislation, Evanston has actually passed a means of finding reparations for African Americans based on the taxation of marijuana. They've linked it to reparations for African Americans. But outside of programs like that, there are very few interventions that I've seen anywhere in the country. There's a lot of talk. We'll see what Biden is able to do. The Black Lives Matter national organization is going through some turmoil now, as there were some shifts within that organization. They're talking about a lot of, not just Black Lives Matter, but a lot of civil rights organizations and organizations focused on racial equity are talking about continuing the protest in order to make sure there's more than just window dressing done by the Biden administration and other other locales. So I'm not sure where we go from here. I think that 2021 will hold may hold as much racial unrest as 2020 did, because there's a lot of there's a lot to the dream of African Americans still being deferred. That's what the early Biden's win doesn't mean a whole lot in terms of returning racial equity, returning a balance or an eye towards racial equity for people who are doing the activist work. They know they need to continue that fight in order to get something.
John, what do you think of reparations for African Americans as a means to address systemic racism? And what do you think needs to be paired with it?
Well, reparations is a very touchy subject. And I kind of brought that up because I only know of one of the only programs in the country where this is being done is in Evanston. But there's different, when we speak of reparations, there's different ways that that's talked about. Some people think it's straight cash transfers. There's others who have done research to show that William Sandy Darity at Duke University has shown that if you open savings accounts and other wealth building measures, that can be a form of reparations to help in particular for children's college fund and the like. So there are, when we say reparations, it's not one definite plan in terms of how that can occur. Mm-hmm. In Evanston, they have offered any Black resident who can prove that their family was discriminated against in the housing market. They've offered returning residents $25,000 towards a home. The issue is the median home value in Evanston is $400,000. That's, $25,000 on a $400,000 home is, it's a start. But even there, that's an interesting proposition. So these are very complicated issues, and I don't think there's a magic bullet to slough off not just slavery, but Jim Crow and what we were just talking about, which is the difference in first versus not first world living, which many African Americans find themselves living in concentrated poverty and residential segregation areas, communities that suffer from those things where you have fewer grocery stores or no grocery stores in the case of Kenosha, disinvestment in neighborhoods from a lack of healthcare organizations or any semblance of healthcare, of a healthcare system. So to think that we can have a magic bullet to cure those ills is going to be very, very difficult. And these are difficult topics because there are people who believe we live in a society that's completely equal at this point. So even having a discussion, I appreciate you bringing all these issues forward to have this discussion.
Well, we appreciate your research and your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you again for having me, and you have a great day.
You too. John Eason, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Madison, founder and director of the UW Justice Lab. You can find a link to a study, by the way, at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we check in on restaurants after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.